So I was just going to go ahead and tape regardless of when we were talking.
Oh, yeah. You know, they did present me with a doctor's degree, you know, Michigan State University.
Right.
And they had a really nice ceremony.
But it was
great ceremony.
Right. That's, I think, the last.
I don't know if I have a bit.
No, I don't think my wife was at that one.
I don't think you are. No.
I was telling her, I don't think I saw you at the Right to Work rally.
No, I wasn't there.
Okay. I remember looking for you, but
well,
I didn't see you.
Well, see, nobody invited me, John. I wouldn't invite that stuff. Since I got out of politics, they don't really invite me to things. They were so jealous of all my accomplishments, John. You'd have thought they'd been happy with the accomplishment. They'd been so jealous that they don't even want me around. They're afraid that, you know, if I come around, nobody will talk to them. I just don't bother with them.
But I know I had seen you at another rally. I don't know if it was a Labor Day rally in Detroit or some other event years ago.
Yeah, well.
But it's been a while. And I also looked for you. I went to the Steelworkers' Anniversary in Cleveland.
Yeah, I wasn't there.
And I didn't see you at that one.
No, they've been pretty chicken shit with me.
That's too bad.
Especially old Gerard, you know, he's been real chicken shit. You know, they're jealous because of the accomplishments we made. They're jealous because you try to tell them, look, we got a lot of problems. We better solve them. Hi, Diane.
Diane,
we're
about Harry Lester.
Diane, it's been a long time since I saw you.
I don't even know when that was.
I thought it was at Dale Brinkner's retirement.
Oh, my goodness.
Been a long time.
That's gone way back. I'm recalling a couple of things I've been at that Harry didn't make, like the Right to Work and
I don't make it because they're, like I say, John, they're so jealous of me, you know, that...
What year did you retire?
When I used to go out, I retired in 2006.
Okay.
When I would go out, we'd always have a contract, you know. We'd have a big turnout, and we'd done some demonstrations. We demonstrated in front of the White House, you know. We demonstrated up Pennsylvania Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere they needed demonstrators, they called me. I was a demonstrator. It was easy to get 400, 500, 600 people out.
Mm-hmm.
And even take them to Washington, D.C. We took a couple thousand to Washington.
All district.
No, what? No, just this district.
This area?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Not just the workers' district?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Was it 29 most of the years?
Well, changed to District 2. I was director of District 29, and it changed it to back 10, 12 years before I retired.
Okay.
I want to take your picture, but then I'm probably going to go explore.
Okay.
Well, you're welcome to stay with us, Diane.
We're going to have lunch here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that will work.
Yeah.
And I have your phone. Thanks.
Okay.
And so then you can join us for lunch.
Yeah, why don't you call me when you're getting ready to do that.
Okay.
One of the places I thought I would try and make you know the area. I haven't been downriver in quite a while. I lived here until the age of 15. So I hadn't really driven myself around too much, but
it hasn't changed a lot much.
So I didn't know if Southland, the mall.
Yeah, Southland is right over here, right over Telegraph. Really, it's off of Eureka. At Southland.
Is that okay area?
You got Ford Farlane over here right on south.
That's a little farther to go.
This Southland's right down the street here. You know, just go down Just take.
Is there much in Wyandotte to
downtown Wyandotte?
Is there very much there?
Not very. Well, yeah, there's quite a bit. It's very exciting. The old Wyandotte, you know, it's changed, but they have quite a few stores in where they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of them have disappeared. A lot of things have disappeared. Walmart's put a lot of them out of business.
Mm-hmm.
Walmart's and Target's.
But
if you want to go to Fairlane, Diane, just go ahead and go right down, back down to Allen Road and take it right down to Eureka and make a right turn, and you're practically there.
Okay, well, I don't want to get too far away because it's just a couple hours from lunch. So.
Okay.
Well, you'll come back to lunch with us, aren't you?
Well, I can do that.
Yeah. Why don't you just plan to be back here at 11:30?
Yeah, right. And have lunch with us. Yeah.
Good.
Okay, thanks.
Have fun.
So we could talk about a lot of things, but I know you did your book and covered your early life in West Virginia, so I wasn't going to ask you really about that.
Well, I got another book just completed. It covers from the time I got to Michigan up until I went on the international staff. That covers 20 years.
Okay,
that covers 1953 or 54 up until 1969.
Okay. So when you moved to Michigan in 53, that was to do what job? Harry Lester, what year were you born?
I was born 1929,
okay.
August 21st, 1929.
In West Virginia.
In a little coal mining tech camp called Bud, West Virginia.
Right, which is why your first book is called The Boy from Bud.
That's right.
Okay, yes. And so did you work in West Virginia?
Well, yes, I did. When I graduated from high school, I started out as a fireman on the railroad.
Okay.
On a steam engine.
Okay.
On those big mountain mallies they had there, they pulled the coal out of the mountains into the street, I guess, to the cities. So I was working there up until I came to Michigan.
Okay. And you came to Michigan in 53, you said?
Yep, 1953, April the 14th, 1953.
And what did you come to Michigan to do?
Well, I come to Michigan to be a machinist. I was a graduate from the Wyoming County Vocational Education as a machinist, and they didn't need machinists when I applied at Ford Rouge plant. The first place I tried was the Ford Rouge in Dearborn, and they didn't need machinists. They needed railroad people.
Okay.
And so I told them I was an engineer, a fireman engineer, but I wasn't a brakeman. They said, oh, yeah, you be a fireman engineer, you can be a brakeman.
Okay.
So they hired me as a switchman conductor.
So you started working for Ford in 53 or so?
Yeah, 53, yeah.
Okay.
The first day of the year, I slept in my car in the parking lot at Gate 4. I was there when the employment office opened the next morning. I was there, ready to go. I went to wash my face in one of the restrooms there, and he got to the interview and went to work that afternoon.
Now, was that a union job or non-union?
Oh, yeah, union job, yeah.
With which union?
With the UAW.
It was part of the UAW Local 600?
Yeah, I was quite active in the Local 600.
Okay.
Well, a short time I was there, then naturally... an engineer's job, a railroad engineer's job, come open at McLouth, and I took that.
What year did you go to McLouth?
54.
Oh, just the next year.
Right.
And it was still in the railroad area?
Well, okay. An engineer instead of a switchman conductor was hired as an engineer.
Okay. And was that all, that had already been unionized, both McLouth and Great Lakes?
Yeah, Local 2659.
Uh-huh. Now, there was a different local for Great Lakes than for McLouth?
Oh, yeah, 1299 Great Lakes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you started being active right away in that?
I got active the first day I was there.
Oh, why was that?
Well, yeah, I could see that here's a new plant and a lot of construction going on all over the plant. And
McLouth was new then?
Oh, yeah, just starting out. You know, they're building a big expansion plant, something like about 100, at that time, I think, $150, $200 million expansion going on in the trim plant, putting in the basic oxygen vessels, putting in the blast furnace, and putting in the rolling mills and reheat furnaces and all this stuff. So there was a lot of construction going on, and there was a lot of... unsafe conditions and unsafe practices.
Uh-huh. That was one of the things I wanted to ask you about a little bit before we got into laborette, was the safety and health has been a big part of your life and career.
That was a big part of my life. That really attracted me to the union. I could see the safety and health problems there, that they had terrible problems. The attitude of the company was, you know, we got a job for you, come to work. And that's all you had to write, was the right to work. Well, I can see right away, the union didn't have the ability to handle this new company with all these new people coming in.
The union was new there, too, then.
New managers, you know. And so I could see right away the railroad department was a very unsafe place to work. If you was on the ground, if you had an engine, you know, you're and make a lot of noise on there.
That's okay. So how many of you were there in the railroad part of McLouth then? That would be just a handful of guys doing
that. Well, we had eventually we had over about 120.
Okay, and how big was McLaughlin employment in those years?
Well, starting out, they wasn't very big. It had less than 2,000 when I went there. They had probably about 1,500 at the Trenton plant. So I went in there pretty early when they was getting that expansion started, but the place started growing.
At that point, was Great Lakes bigger then?
Oh, yeah, Great Lakes three or four times bigger than McLaughlin.
Okay.
Yeah, they were always big brother, you know, and he acted like big brother. But the thing is, I could see that union leadership was very lacking. I don't know if they I don't want to knock the guys, but I don't know if they had the ability to take the people on, or if they knew how to do it, or even if they wanted to. It seemed like I could see this with workers. Our workers was more interested in taking care of themselves. You know, a new company, I'm going to work my way up. I'm buying for the good job.
Now, McLaughlin was two facilities at that point? Or
they had Trenton and Detroit.
Okay.
And in the process of building Gibraltar, Gibraltar hadn't started yet.
And were you always at
Trenton.
Always at Trenton. Okay.
That was the big plan.
Okay.
And it grew to be about somewhere between 3,600 and 1,000 people, you know, when it finally reached its peak. And
so what kind of safety problems?
Well, I mean, kind of would go to throw a switch. You couldn't throw the switch. It'd pull his back out of place trying to throw a switch. He didn't grease the switches, didn't crease the switches. There was scrap all over the walkways. There was the walkways, you might get off a train, you know, if you're getting off a train, if you didn't look very carefully, you might step in a sinkhole or your mud hole. Or you might step on a piece of scrap and throw you under the car. And at night, it was extremely dangerous because, you know.
They work around the clock?
Or? Oh, yeah, 24-7.
Three shifts then?
Yeah, 24-7. Yeah, and I got complaining about it. Well, in my new book, when you read the new one, I complained about it. They said, go back to West Virginia. We don't need no hillbillies up here. If you don't like it here, go back. Quit. You don't have to work here. I said, I come to stay, man.
Okay.
I don't plan to quit.
Now, among the people, a lot of directions I could go with that, but were there a lot of people from down south in that plant or not?
No, there was people from everywhere in that plant.
Everywhere, okay.
You know, you had them from North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, Ohio, California, you name it, they were represented. West Virginia had quite a few. Kentucky had quite a few.
Was there much ethnic mix or not?
A lot of Greeks.
A lot of Greeks. Interesting.
Oh, a lot of Greeks. And they were my good friends. I got along good with the Greeks.
Now, what was the racial balance at that point? Was it pretty much exclusively white?
Yeah, it was no blacks. They wouldn't hire black. They didn't have a black anywhere in Trenton.
Until the 60s? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Until we made them iron.
Before you go to that story, what were the trains being used for?
Oh, transport product. You transported coke, iron ore, limestone.
Those are all coming in.
All of them coming in and going out. You ship it out, too. You know, you had to ship in the departure yard, what they call it, where you shipped out coals to different places.
Okay.
So we was doing a lot of railroad shipping at the time. The railroad pretty much had the shipping at that time. It was way before the trucks. They come in later, you know, and start hauling everything.
So most of it was done by the train, not by trucks.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, shipped right out of that plant. Well, shipped a lot of steel out of that plant.
So how did you get do you remember who was the union leadership at that time?
When I first went there, they had a guy by the name of Grugin. Ernie Grugin was the president. And Pete Capato was the grievance chairman. And had a guy by the name of Ray Knezik and Ray Hood and a few other people, you know.
And how did you first get involved?
Well, I got to raise question the company and question the supervisors about the safety condition. And the people liked it. The rest of them was afraid to talk up. I wasn't afraid. I never was afraid of anything. I could get a job. Like I told them, hey, I was looking for a job, and I found this one. You're not going to scare me.
Was that because you had these other skills, and so it was easier for you
skills.
To think
I,
of yourself to go
skills.
Up?
I didn't have to worry about no job. I could I was a welder. I was a machinist. As far as working on the railroad, I could get a job on any of the outside railroads because that was my experience. I was an outside railroad guy, the road guy. So And those jobs, it was a lot of those jobs, hadn't they? So anyway, like I told them, you're not going to scare me. Because they said, well, you didn't know you're working around here very long. I said, well, I was looking for a job and found this one. But as long as I'm around here, you're going to deal with me. And I was the selected shop steward. Our grievance, we called it a grievance man.
Mm-hmm.
I was elected a grievance man.
54, 55, somewhere like
54,
that?
I was there. I was there 30 days. I was elected. Grievance guy. And I said, boy, they saw something in me that I didn't see because I didn't know anything about it. I just knew I liked the union. I knew the union was good.
Because of your West Virginia heritage?
Yeah, my dad was a very active union man. I saw what the union did for the coal miners, and I knew that they could do the same thing for the steelworkers.
Uh-huh.
So, and I was brought up in a union house, and I taught union, believe union. And the whole family believed union. The whole Lester family were a very, very strong union.
Uh-huh. This all mine workers?
All mine workers.
Uh-huh.
So they...
So you got involved as a grievance committee, grievance man?
A grievance man and safety. I was a safety grievance, safety representative and also for the railroad department and also the grievance representative of the railroad department. So I started questioning the safety. And we get the same old excuses. The local president said, you know, you shouldn't take us too, I said, no offense, Harry, but you shouldn't take us too serious. I said, well, I take everything very serious, especially safety and health,
uh-huh,
very serious. So I wrote my first grievance. I go in to handle a grievance, and I didn't know much. I hadn't read the contract. I hadn't studied the bylaws and the steelworker constitution. I was pretty smart. I knew I was smart because, you know, I graduated high in my class because I knew I was smart. And
but you were still green at this.
At least I thought I was.
Uh-huh.
I go in there and, you know, spoke to them with a nice friendly smile. Shit, they look over at me and say, we've heard about you. Well, I hope it's good. Well, it's not too damn good that you can head out back to West Virginia anytime you get ready. That's the way the business started. So the grievance chairman read the grievance.
I assume on management side they didn't have much safety expertise at all at a local.
Shit, they could care less. You know, and the union, they bossed the union. They pretty well dominated the union. So I'll show you, give you an illustration. They looked over. The grievance chairman read the grievance in the record. And they looked over to him and said, what portion of the contract we violated? He said, hell, I don't know. So he looked over to the local president. Ask him. He said, hell, I don't know. Ask him. He wrote the grievance. I'm looking, shit, I haven't even read that thing. I don't know what to violate. I just know it's right, the right thing to do, that we should have it, a lunch period, you know.
Is that what that one was over?
Yeah, a lunch period, yeah.
Okay.
We had to have a lunch period.
So, there wasn't any at that point?
Well, no. Hey, shit, you worked your 8 hours or 16. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to provide no. They said there's no place in the contract to provide for lunch period.
Mm-hmm.
So they look at me. So, what part of the contract are we violating? Well, I had read a few pages, and I read the scope of the agreement. The scope of the agreement said that any time the union or the union officials have a problem, the company will sit down and discuss the problem with them.
Okay.
I said, that's what he says. He said, that's not what he... I said, well, why'd you put it in the agreement for? Because that's what I think you violated. He said, there's no... In the contract, no place do they provide for lunch break.
Wow.
I said, well, there's going to be. They said, oh, no. You'll be long gone before there's ever lunch period. I said, do you have a boss? Well, hell yeah, everybody has a boss. That's right. You have a boss, so you don't get it. So, no, I'll never be overruled, he said. Well, in that result, they finally were, because they couldn't get nothing done. We had it set up for the railroad. I said, the only way you're going to get their attention, as long as we do everything they tell us to do, we're getting in a hurry, but they've been moving too fast. Just, we'll work with the rule. We'll work safe.
Uh-huh.
They couldn't handle it. Finally, they give in. and we established a lunch period. Railroad was the only department at McLeod that had a lunch period.
Oh, so you got it first for the railroad group, and
then the rest of the
came later.
Come later.
That's fascinating.
Well, that was the experience. Yeah.
That was your first one.
Then I went to the University of Michigan. Met with High Kornblum and got involved with the labor studies. And I started studying. I took that labor law. I took contract negotiations, grievance handling, arbitration, labor history. I took them all. And economics, advanced economics and collective bargaining.
Were those classes in Ann Arbor, or they were here, or they were in Wayne State?
In Ann Arbor when I went, then they moved them down to Wayne State, and I went to Wayne State.
Okay. What year do you think you took some of those classes?
Some of them, they hadn't been in existence very long when I started taking them. I think it's somewhere about 1955, 56.
Really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, early, because it wasn't. High Kornblum was head, and Gene Brooke was head of the one in Wayne State.
Right.
And Michigan State was a guy by the name, I'm trying to think of his name. He went to the steelworkers as their director. What's his name? I know him real well.
Well,
Russ Allen, you know, he went too. Russ was there for a while.
Well, I know Russ.
Now, Russ is a good guy. You know.
You're talking about Fred Haler.
Fred Haler. I just couldn't think of Fred. Fred was there. And when I was on the board there, you had a guy like Brendan Saxton. You remember Brendan? Yeah.
He was part of the U of M group.
Oh, yeah. He was part of the U, yeah. And also, you know, UAW. Yeah, heavy guy.
Right.
UAW.
So you started taking some of those labor studies classes in the late 50s.
Oh, yeah.
And you took them you drove to Ann Arbor to take them in those days?
Yeah, I did.
They weren't holding any at the Union Halls around here?
No, they didn't start that until I took over. When I took over as the education director for the steelworkers.
When was that?
I took over the education director in 1969.
Okay. I'll come back to that later. But that was for District?
District 29.
For District 29.
Yeah.
Was that your first job with the district?
Well, I was an international staff representative, and I set up the education program. Well, I did when I went on staff. So young, but I didn't want to just be a staff representative, a typical staff representative that just handles contracts. I want to be a staff representative that's an overhaul staff representative that gets involved in all social programs,
uh-huh.
Labor education, political action. Sports and recreation. I said, I want to be a well-rounded guy. I don't want to be just a one-shot technician, whatever you call it. He said, well, can you handle it? I said, I can handle both of them. And all this crap you hear about these burned-out people, they're not burned out, they're cops out. You know, they don't want to do the work. You can go to do the work.
Were you the first education director?
Yeah.
Okay. They didn't really have that position before.
No. If they had it, it was dormant.
No. Was the model for much of that, Harry, things going on in the steelworkers, or in this kind of area, was it what's happening in the UAW because of their size?
Well, a little of both. Well, UAW has always been very good in education. I was so impressed with UAW when I first came up here. A little story I have in the book, if you don't mind me telling.
No, go ahead.
When I first started work at Ford's, I used to listen to Guy Nunn,
right.
Gene Brooke, and what was his name? Kind of knew him real well. Anyway, it's Guy Nunn, Gene Brooke, and
on the radio, or you?
Yeah, on the radio. Eye opener and shift break.
Right.
I used to listen to him tune in every day, man. That was a good program.
Uh huh.
And boy, I used to think, God, I'd like to meet those guys. And I finally did get to meet them.
Did you?
And even got some of their long plays, those long disc records that they had the programs on.
Uh-huh.
They put on some great programs. But anyway, I was impressed with the UAW and the way they put out way they conducted themselves. They were great, and Walter Reuther was just a great leader, you know. They were great in political action. They knew their stuff. They were great in labor education, and they was great in just about anything they did.
Well, they're big here, too. They were innovative, big, progressive.
But, you know, the thing is, I showed the steel workers, you don't have to be big to do that.
Uh-huh.
You can do that. You can't be the head dog. You don't have to be the head dog. Just do your thing, you know. And I had better support than UAW did the steel workers, really.
In doing some of the education?
A lot of the programs. Because you had all these people that were afraid that you're going to show them up. I never was afraid of anybody showing me up.
Uh-huh.
They were afraid you're going to show you up and get jealous of you and start pissing in the ears, you know. They're giving the wrong information out. But I felt this, that, look, I'm going to do the best job I can. I don't want to just be a typical staff representative. I want to be the best.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I went to labor school. That's why I took all these, got involved with everything. Got involved with the political action, sports and recreation.
What you do in sports and recreation? You mentioned that a couple of times.
I was appointed director by the president of the local 2659, and the company, McLaughlin's company, to be the sports director for the company and the union.
So what did you do? What kinds of things did you do?
Well, I did. We didn't have nothing. Two Class A baseball teams played Class A baseball in Wyandotte. Two fast pitch ball teams that played Trenton and Wyandotte.
Uh-huh.
Two basketball teams that come, this is adult teams, that competed locally and also internationally.
This being made up of your members?
Yeah. And had 20 slow pitch softball teams.
Wow.
The American League and the National League.
Wow.
All three plants, company and union, played. One of these, Warner, the vice president of operations, told me once, he said, I just wish that we could get the cooperation from the rest of the union and the workers as we do in the sports and recreation program. Mm-hmm. We had.
Did you think it helped solving other problems?
It helped a lot.
Improved relations?
Relations, and it got people knowing each other. It got families together. The families would come out to the ball games bring your picnic lunches, and it was just a really a family type of thing that worked out very well. And like everything, you know, it worked out real good as long as I was there running it. When I left, it kind of just...
When you went to the district, you mean?
Yeah, when I went to the district, that's when it started. Well, as long as I was president, I had my guy in and run it, and I just kept a handle on it, you know, make sure he's doing the things that I felt we should do to actually provide the recreation. And we had bowling teams. We had something like about 30 different leagues, bowling leagues, and about 6 different leagues of golf leagues. we had one heck of a ball. At that time, I had about a $25,000 budget to work with.
Uh-huh.
And back in those days, that $25,000 was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you keep doing the grievance stuff, or did you kind of pass that along?
No, I was to keep doing it. John, I've become one of the best arbitrators for the union, you know, the defense lawyers for the union, or what would you call it, prosecutors for the union.
Uh-huh.
I was one of the best. I never lost very many grievances. And people go, well, you must be lucky. I said, ain't no luck. I said, hard work makes a lot of good luck. I won cases you wouldn't believe. I'm going to write a book just on the cases I handled. I got some very interesting cases that I'd done all the preparatory work for it.
Can you remember any of the kinds of issues?
Yeah, I can remember shit. I remember the issues. Let me tell you one that dates me way ahead of my time. We had this young guy from the work of the South.
Mm-hmm.
He gets fired. He's working in the pickle department. Very nice guy. Nice, big, tall guy. Real pretty healthy guy. And he looked like an athlete. He looked like a Marine, you know.
Okay.
Anyway, he gets fired. 6 different counts of misconduct. Bringing alcohol into the plant, which is a discharge. Being drunk on the job. Breaking equipment, cussing the supervisor, fighting the supervisor, and just about killing him, and refusing to leave the plant.
Okay. All in one sort of day?
All in one day.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't leave the plant. The only way this.
So he got drunk and got crazy.
Well, the people couldn't get him out of the plant. So.
But he had been there a while. He was a good employee otherwise.
Well, he hadn't been there very long.
Oh.
Well, that's the story. When you see the story, you can relate it to what we got right now, that's been ignored by our government. This guy had come out as when he was fired, and the local said, "Well, you got to arbitrate his case. He's a good guy." I said, "We got a lot of good guys." But, "God, you real 6 counts of misconduct?" They said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, God, yeah, there's no way an arbitrator in this world put a guy back with 6 counts, especially the guy had his jaw broken about 5 different places. They had pictures of his blue back and blue hole.
Are you ringing?
Huh? Oh, I didn't have, no, the company had it. I didn't have it. I wish I did.
No, was that a phone ringing?
Anyway,
so he had all this stuff going against him.
I had all this going.
And you didn't think there was much hope.
Well, I didn't think. I had the third step and held the third step for him, and it looked good. So we had the interview before we went to arbitration. I interviewed him the day before, like I always did. I always interviewed him either a week or a day before. So we're all sitting out the same hymn book. So I'd learned how to arbitrate grievance because I'd studied it. You know, I'd studied labor law, and I knew labor law well enough to know that what was lawful and what wasn't. So anyway, I was asking the guy, I said, "You been in service?" He said, "Yeah." "Vietnam, yeah." 4 different tours of duty. "What branch of service?" "Green Beret." "What, you get any medals?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I got a couple medals." I said, "What I kind of wanted to do?" He said, "Well, they'd drop me behind the lines, and I'd be behind the lines for 4 or 5 months, you know, spying on the enemy, and, you know, doing that, what they did." And I said, "But you do have the medals." Yeah. He said, I said, "Well, why don't you bring them with you when you come to the arbitration tomorrow?" So we get in, and boy, the company put on this case.
Is this in front of an outside arbitrator?
Oh, yeah, partial arbitrator, yeah.
Okay.
And
is this the final step in the procedure?
It's the final step
then?
In the procedure, final binding. So they presented a case. They showed these pictures, these gruesome pictures of this guy. Boy, he was beat up. I'll tell you, this guy done a job on him. But anyway, they said, "I don't even know what we're here for." So they looked over and said, "Call for a summary dismissal." I said, "What are you talking about, dismissal?" "Yeah, well, look, you don't have no case. You know," I said, "I do have a case, Mr. Arbitrator, and I want to prove my case, and I can prove it to you beyond any reasonable doubt that this man should not be fired. He should be working." So they said, "Well, go for it." So I put the guy on the stand, and he admitted this, and I said, "What? You have your background. But he come in with all these medals. Shit, he looked like General Patton."
You had him with
you had him on. You know, I told him where.
Right.
Had all these medals, had these citations, shit, from Westmoreland and all of God, I was very impressed with it. And so asked him, you know, his tour sheet said how long he'd been in service and some of the work he did. He's a Green Beret, and that required special services and so forth and so on. And I said, "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, I'm doing my job. This foreman's been riding me for a week, you know. And he's trying to accuse me of things I'm not doing. He's trying to accuse me of being drunk. I wasn't drunk. I was just trying to do my job." So he comes up and he starts yakking. Well, I had about enough of it. So I said a few things to him. And he comes up and punches me in the chest. And he said, "I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. He's a black guy. I don't know. I don't remember hitting this guy."
Yeah.
So, in summation of my case, I told the arbitrator, "Mr. Arbitrator, I think the company has an argument, but they don't have no argument with this guy, this man here, or with the union. They have an argument with the U.S. government. The U.S. government trained this man to kill. They didn't train him to just hurt people. They trained him to kill people. And no doubt he's killed a lot of people. And no doubt when he thought this guy punched him, it just he lost it because it was Vietnamese people, you know, or the Viet Cong or something. He thought it was the enemy, and he just lost it. I said, if you want to blame someone, blame the government for not reorientating this person when you brought him back into civil life. I said, you know, back into society. I said, they bring all these soldiers back. They don't reorientate them. They don't treat them. A lot of soldiers have very serious problems. I said, you can read a story every day about some soldier, you know, coming back from Vietnam, either killing himself or killing someone or doing something. Arbitrator put him back to work.
Wow. I assume he got some penalty of some sort.
Well, he did. He didn't get no pay.
For whatever long time took.
Well,
might have been half a year.
No, it only took about 3 months. We
3 months.
Moved pretty fast, yeah.
Uh-huh. So 3 months back without pay, put him back to work.
But the thing is, John, sad part about it, they put him back to work, but it didn't last because they didn't orientate these people back into society, you know.
Uh-huh.
Bring them back and reorientate them. You train a person to kill like a dog. You train them to shit. You got to reprogram the guy.
But so there's an example of a case you won that nobody thought you could.
Oh, no one thought. It was really something. I got some more that are almost impossible, but we won them. People say, how'd you win? I said, because I studied it. You come out with new ideas. New ways. You don't just keep doing the same thing all the time. You get creative. You get creative and do a little work, and you'll be surprised what you can do.
Do you remember any of the arbitrators you ever?
Oh, heavens, yeah. I had Howard Cole on the best. Houghton, you remember? What's his
Ron?
Name? Ron Houghton.
Yeah.
Nate Lipson.
I was wondering if you ever had my buddy Dan Kruger for a case.
I think I had Kruger for one case, but I also had
Stieber.
Who?
Jack Stieber.
I had Stieber for one case, but Jack, he and I didn't. Yeah, no, he was too company orientated for me.
Was he?
Huh. Yeah. Now he got he's retired. He got better, but I wouldn't use Jack even after he retired because I didn't trust him.
Killingsworth ever?
Killingsworth used Killingsworth. Uh-huh. And Leon Herman.
Hmm. Interesting.
Oh, I used most all of them. I was trying to think of the guy that I liked so well. He was a big guy. What was his name? He was good. I liked him. He was a good arbitrator.
Somebody from in Michigan?
Yeah.
Detroit area, you think?
Yeah, from the Detroit area.
Hmm.
I can't think of his name right now. But I probably have those around some more than names. But
don't worry about it. I don't care. I just was curious if you had any of those MSU people that I used to work with.
Yeah, I had most all of them because we arbitrated a lot of cases. I arbitrated while I was a staff guy. I arbitrated before.
I was assuming that, like the case you were describing, you were already on the staff when you did that case.
Oh, yeah, I was staff, yeah. I'd done some with the local president, but I was staff when I'd done it. I've done the most of my cases.
So what years were you local president?
I was local president 1962 to 1969.
Okay.
I was also vice president from 1958.
Okay.
Up until 1960.
Okay.
And I was also chief negotiator for the plan in 1958-59 when they had the long steel strike.
You want to tell me a little bit about that, why you just mentioned it?
Yeah, the long steel strike, I was, 1958, I was elected onto the negotiating committee to represent the Trenton plant, which was the largest plant. And we also elected a new president. I was also vice president, too, and also chief negotiator. We elected a new president, too. We finally cleaned house with the people that we couldn't get no help from, you know. And that's that in my way of trying to block me from moving. And
is Young Love in the district office at this point?
What's that?
Is Young Love in the district office
no,
at this time?
Tom
he comes later.
He comes later, yeah.
Okay.
He comes later. We get together and do things different than they've ever done before. My insistence with the president, and he and I were very good friends, that we get together with our members each department and find out what they want.
Uh-huh.
Instead of us telling them what they want, let them tell us what they want.
Uh-huh.
And so we did that for each department. We come up with a booklet, and we put our, all these separated, the duplicates, got all the duplicates and everything separated, come up with a proposal for each.
The members' concerns and proposals?
Oh, yeah, right. But it concerned all three different plants, because you had three plants operating at that time. So we got them all together and put them in a nice booklet and presented to the company. The company liked to find it. They'd never seen that before.
Hmm.
That was introducing something new to them. And right away, they took offense to that.
Right away.
You can see right away they had a problem. So anyway, because a lot of safety and health stuff was involved in that. And you know, naturally, we were insistent on safety and health. And we started negotiating. We negotiated. And I was telling my wife, she said, and I say, Mary, I think, you know, what they generally do, but I've observed this in the past, they generally do, they negotiate real strong right up until the deadline, then they get a contract. And I said, we had some money saved up, so I said, I think what we'll do, we ought to buy us a new car. You can buy a new car for $2,000, you know.
Okay.
We had $3,500 saved. So she said, I think we better wait and see how this contract's going to go. I said, I think it's going to be all right. Well, we come up to the deadline. They extended it for 15 days. I said, well, we'll get it settled down. Well, I should have known there's nothing moving. But my hopes were so high.
Sure.
I wanted to get it. I figured maybe some kind of miracle would happen. Well,
right.
It didn't happen. Well, we were on strike. What happened was that Roger Blaw and was his name?
It's okay.
Anyway, U.S. Steel was leading the show.
I mean, it's a big national strike of everybody.
Oh, yeah, everybody. All steelworkers on strike.
Right.
Everybody was on strike. And we was on strike. God, I'll tell you. And we're not moving. On strike is still nothing moving. Nothing happens. Well, eventually, make a long story short, you know, spent everything we had when the thing was over, but Eisenhower put us back to work under the Taft Hartley Law. The first time the Taft Hartley Law had ever been invoked against the Union, put us back to work after 118 days on strike.
118.
118 days, yeah. The whole steel industry was down.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sued the Union to go back, and we took it to Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld him. So anyway, during this time now, we had met with the company and met with the company. We got $4 a day for expenses. It took $2 to park the car at Fort Shelby Hotel and $2 to eat. And a lot of times, you start late at night. And but anyway, I went in the hole on the deal. The union didn't take all wages was cut out. Nobody got any wages, only expenses.
Let's take a break.
Well, we went back to work under the Dave Hartley injunction.
Uh-huh.
And we all wore black armbands, like slaves, you know.
Okay.
That was all during that Taft Hartley injunction, we wore black armbands with like slaves. And, we were still trying to get this thing solved all through this 80-day cooling off period. Well, International moved. Eisenhower got them in the White House, and he moved them.
Uh-huh.
And they come up with a settlement. We couldn't seem to get the company to move. So Tom Shane, the director, the president.
District director?
Yeah, and staff guy. They said, well, let's see if we can meet separately with them and see if we can get them all. I didn't agree with it. I said, I think it's that if they want to meet, let them come here and meet with the whole committee. Well, the rest of the committee voted me down, and so they met. Next thing we know, we're watching TV, and what do we see on TV? Tom Shane and Hal Warner announcing that they had an extension, 15-day extension.
Hmm.
Well, shit, people went berserk. They called down and said, we don't know what's going on. Nobody told us anything. But they'd got together and done, and we get the 15. Well, People shut the plant down. I mean, they not all shut it down. They went berserk. I never saw such a bunch of angry people in my life. Mm-hmm.
They felt they were turned off by the union.
Yeah, they were double crossed. They tore down the guard shanty and everything else. It was terrible. It was a deal. Anyway, they called for the agreement that Tom Shane and these three had reached, not the committee. Called for a meeting. And at a ratification meeting at the Lancaster Hotel there in River Rouge. Mm-hmm. Actually, they come in, they wrecked our people. They were so angry at Tom Shane and the committee that they pretty well done about over $3,500 of the damage to that theater. Mm-hmm. And nothing happened. I've had to adjourn the meeting because they got so hostile.
What theater was this?
The Lancaster over in River Rouge.
Is that where you held some of your meetings?
That's where we didn't hold one there after that, though. They wouldn't let us. We had a hard time finding the place after that. Well, anyway, they sent a real deep message. So we go back in and negotiate with the company. The company heard all about this. Staff guy was Tom Shane's nephew. Mm. Was a staff guy. And he was starting set. So anyway, he always said, we're not in trouble. The company's in trouble. All the steel, industry back to work. We got to get this company back. I said, who are you for, us or them?
So Great Lakes was back to work.
Oh, yeah.
And Bruce Steel was back.
Yeah, everybody was working with us. We were out. I said, we got the hammer. Right now is the time to correct these conditions that we promised the people we were going to correct.
Uh-huh.
And we must do that. And so he said, I don't know why in the hell you don't go back to West Virginia. You're just like all railroads. I said, well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm not going back to West Virginia. And I'm telling you one thing, too. We're going to take care of this contract. And then I said, if you're too yellow to negotiate this contract, you're such a coward that you're afraid to deal with the company, then I'll deal with it. He said, I'm not yellow. I said, well, you must be. I can't get anything out of you. All I hear you defending the company. What are you, gone the company's payroll to? He said, you say that again, I'll sock you. I said, I've repeated exactly. You're yellow, you're a coward, you're afraid to fight. That guy, he was sitting up on a little old Ian Schwartz and the president and the previous chairman sitting up on a little high rise. I guess it got on the podium, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And the committee was sitting down here and we were having this argument ourselves. I'm sitting in the very back on the table.
Sure.
So he jumps off that table or jumps off that podium, come running at me. Well, shall I get on? That was a mistake he made. Because I don't know of anything I like to do better than fight. So he comes and I knew exactly what he was going to do because I'd had this happen before. You know, I knew what he was going to do. He gets close to me and he tries to kick me in the nuts. It's about time he raises his foot to kick me. I caught him right in the jaw. I mean, square on the jaw. His head hit the side of John. It ripped his head open. He hit the side of that building. He went down like he was shot out of a cannon. Well, I jumped on him. I was going to finish his ass off. You know, you're going to try to nut me, you know. If you want to fight dirty, I'll show you how to fight dirty. It took four of them to pull me off of him. But I'll tell you one thing. We went in and took care of some business. He acted like he had some sense then, but I knew one thing. My days were numbered with the steelworkers. Yeah, my days are numbered because that's the director's son-in-law. There is a nephew. He's not going to let me get away with that. Although the guy started, he was one of these special service army guys too. You know.
Okay.
I told him I didn't give a shit in the special service. They told me that our guys told me that. Are you crazy? I said shit. I ain't afraid of that guy. Special services. I was in special services in Bud Cole Camp growing up. That was my special services.
But you ended up surviving, and he ended up not staying.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I ended up surviving because Tom Shane got defeated after that, because after that I knew I had to make a different plan, so I contacted Young Love.
Who was Great Lakes?
Well, Chuck was a staff guy at the International.
Oh. Okay.
And he worked for Tom Shane. I was talking to Chuck about running for director.
Mm-hmm.
And I assured him that it would get McLeod and that we could win the election. So after a few meetings and you get together with the committees, Chuck was elected in 1960.
Uh-huh.
And that was right after that big long strike, and right after the had the fight with the director's nephew.
But you helped deliver McLeod votes for him?
Oh, yeah, I delivered solid, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, the president went with Tom Shane because Tom Shane, he made the deal with Tom Shane, that agreement.
Uh-huh.
That's where he and I fell out. He made some kind of a deal to take a staff job and try to sell an inferior contract in him parting company. He went on staff, and so he was supporting Shane, but I had the political machine there in McLeod. I had a great political machine.
At this time, McLeod had three facilities?
Yeah.
What was the balance of what was done and about how many employees were at each?
Well, right at that time, it's about 4,400 employees.
Uh-huh.
And at my pinnacle when I left, it had 46,000 or 4,600. So it was about 4,400 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And working all three plants, Trenton being the big plant.
Uh-huh. And the local was near there.
The local was local 2659. Yeah, it was located in Southeast, still the same place.
And where was the district office then?
The district office was in the Fox Building downtown.
Okay.
And then they moved to, later on, after Chuck got elected, we moved it out of downtown, moved it down to Allen Park.
Yeah, that's where I came and visited you and George Watts for some mm-hmm. labor education planning event or
right,
some
yes.
kind of reason like that.
Yeah, George was in my opposition a couple of times. He ran against me a couple of times.
What did he come out of? Great Lake?
He came out of Trenton.
Oh, he was out
yeah,
of Trenton.
Trenton yeah.
Okay.
He came out, he was grievance chairman when we defeated George when we put Swartz in.
Uh-huh.
Then George come back and got reelected grievance chairman in 1960 and 62 when I ran for president. George ran for president too. And he ran again in 1964. Mm-hmm. Time. But I realized George was a good guy. All they needed was someone to you know, some good solid direction. He made a good assistant for me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But he was your assistant for a number of years before he went to work for the AFL, right?
No, he come from the AFL to be my assistant. Yeah. You know, he left the AFL, the Secretary of Treasury job, to be my assistant.
Okay, I forgot the order of how that went.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Before doing the labor studies, you mentioned about labor and politics. I wonder if you could, I'm not as familiar with the downriver activity and your connections with the political scene, but I assume you were very involved.
Oh, very well connected with all the elections in the downriver community, John. I was a mover and shaker in the politics in downtown and
uh-huh.
in the downriver community. And Chuck Younglove was a real power broker. Chuck was a great director. He done a great job. He very active in politics. And when he appointed me to head up the John staff, and he recommended IW Able for me. I told him about the labor education and the political action and the recreation, and he turned me loose and said, "Hey, you do whatever you think is necessary, I'll support you. Whatever you do, I'll support you."
Uh-huh.
Had a blank check, and that made it easy because Chuck would participate with me in different things, and especially in politics. We were very active in politics, and we would screen our candidates. We had a good screening process. We screened our candidates, the one we were going to go with. Normally we went with the FLCO, whatever, because Chuck was a big leader in the FLCO, same as I was when I was director. And
now, are you talking mostly in this community, or are you talking the whole district-wide?
I'm talking about the whole district-wide.
And what was the district boundaries in those days?
Well, in those days, the district had all of Lower Michigan, and the 13 northwestern counties in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
That was District 29. So we was active in all those counties, every one of them.
So when you talk about screening, you would, this includes the Toledo areas as well as...
Yeah, we'd screen Canada's out. Or if the AFL screened them out, we'd go with the AFL if they screened them. But we had people on the screening committee of the AFL, so we were part of the screening of selecting candidates. And one interesting thing, John, that you'll be very interested in, when I was local president, in 1968, we had a teacher's problem in Gibraltar School District.
Uh-huh.
That's when teachers were getting organized and trying to get a decent wage, you know. You ever hear of the John Birch Society?
Sure.
Tea Party?
Mm-hmm.
Well, John Birch Society moved into Gibraltar because Gibraltar had a real social-minded bunch of leaders, union leaders, teachers. You had both. You had MEA and the FT.
Right.
And they were pretty much equally divided. Well,
AFT had a few of the districts, like probably Taylor. Dearborn was AFT.
We tried to make it a full AFT there, but we couldn't. They had good people in both. They were both good. I can't complain about the Federation or the MEA. They were both good.
Okay, and you worked with both.
I worked with both of them. We, in 1967, Joe Henson and I, who was with the Oil Tommy Chemical Workers, helped the teachers negotiate your contract, and they got a contract. Well, they told the teachers this is the last time that. When 68 rolled around, they fired all the teachers.
Uh-huh.
Teachers were on strike, and they fired them all. Well, I made up a committee before this, when we first started, because I knew we had to. So I set up a committee called Citizens for Quality Education. Now, I'm president of McLeod Local, a big local, very predominant in the downtown, and I was a very well-known individual in the downtown community. So they brought in their John Birch's band. I tell you, you've never dealt with a bunch of ASOs until you deal with the John Birch Society.
Mm.
They were out of this world. They didn't feel these teachers had any rights. The only right they had was to work and to shut up. So anyway, they fired the teachers. I took them to court. Harry Lester versus Gibraltar School Board.
Oh.
You know who my attorney was? Bernie Feiger.
Oh. You know, interesting.
Yeah,
sure.
His son.
Yeah.
Well, I knew his son was just a shit kid then.
Funny.
Bernie, yeah. Bernie was a good attorney, and you know June Feiger. That was his wife, and that was Feiger's mother. She was the international representative for the Federation of Teachers. And Roger Craig, which is pulling the name out of history, you know, was also the attorney. We took him to court and we beat him, John. Judge Ryan, you know, he finally went to the state Supreme Court.
Uh-huh.
He was in the county at that time, so he said, well, he didn't want to break any new ground or anything. Didn't want to plow a new fur and all that. I said, we're not plowing no new fur. You're just doing what's right. He reinstated the teachers. Well, the teachers, both the MEA and the Federation, they get pissed off. I wasn't going back to work for these people.
Hmm.
I said, shit, you got to. The judges ruled you to go back. You know, the thing is, we've already presented a miracle here, getting you back to making reinstate you back with all your seniority and all your rights. And so anyway, we agreed with it. Well, I'll tell you one thing. We'll agree. Well, we will agree to go back if you recall that school board.
Uh-huh.
You got a deal. Call the bastards. Boy, what an experience, John.
Wow.
We checked with every one of the board members. They were solid behind those Birchers. Solid. They wouldn't break ranks. We tried to break one of them off. We couldn't break. So we recalled seven. So we had a fight for seven. They pulled every dirty, rotten trick in the book. They tried to get me kicked out of my church. I was a Sunday school teacher at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to get the church to kick me out, and they wouldn't. They tried to get the members at McLeod's. When they went to McLeod's members, they said, we support him. Anyway, that's not what you're paying him for and all this stuff. So anyway, We finally got it settled. We did recall them because of we was trying to recall 7, which is unheard of to start with. And they said, we'll get rid of them at the due process and election time. And they did, which is only 6 months away.
Uh-huh.
And that was a success story.
Yeah, that's quite a story.
A success story.
I'm curious at that point, in terms of the politics angle, was this almost entirely with the Democrats, or were there any moderate?
You had a few moderate Republicans, but most of them are Democrats.
Uh-huh.
I'm always in a very strong Democratic area. Now,
yeah.
Tom Berger's, you know, they were right-wingers. You know, you wasn't no give or take of
yeah.
them.
Well, that's what made me think about it, because I usually think of this as John Dingell in his dad's district forever, and pretty strong Democratic district. We skipped by McClouth hiring black workers and what was the union's role in discrimination cases and...
Well, our role was starting that. When I first started in there, they said, they don't hire no niggers. And I said, hey, I don't use that word. I said, some of my very best friends are Afro-Americans, and I'm not going to have you referring to them as niggers. And the company was very outspoken on it. They wasn't going to hire no blacks. So I said, yeah, you're going to hire blacks. And when I got elected president now, that's when we really start putting the heat on.
Uh-huh.
And they had to start hiring. They had to start hiring. Even before the law changed, they had to start hiring them because I put so much pressure on them that they think we're going to strike you if you don't hire. You got to hire some Afro-Americans.
So it's very different than the Rouge, which had a pretty large contingent of African-American workers.
Yeah, we didn't have any. When I was elected president, '62, we maybe have a couple. I started hiring them, they found out later that those Afro-Americans was as good or better than some of the other ones they had.
Now, I forget, did Tom Turner come out of Great Lakes? Or?
Yeah, he came out of Great Lakes.
Okay.
But Great Lakes always had Afro-American. Trenton, mm-hmm. I think, was Trenton, Gibraltar. I never could find this out. I tried. I accused them of it many times, that they had a deal with the city not to hire black people.
Trenton
plant and the Gibraltar plant, yeah.
Mm.
I think that I can't prove that, but I think it did. But anyway, we told them, you're going to make a choice. You got to start hiring.
Was Tom...
If it's discrimination, you know, we didn't have any problem making them hire my friends, the Greek, because the Greeks are my good friends. And I would just make sure they hired the Greeks. And also, I've got a lot of Afro-Americans hired in there, too. Well, I had some very good Afro-American friends. Grew up with, I guess you read my book about Doc Ingram, the truck driver, the father image I have, the black guy that drove a truck.
Not your new one, so I don't
know.
Well,
I think that's in the old book, too. I think, and I believe, I'm sure I talked about Doc.
Is the new one out?
No, the new one's going to be coming out before Christmas.
And how are you writing that?
Well,
sitting with a tape recorder like this?
Oh, heavens no.
No?
I use a computer. Shit, I can do more work on the computer than anything else. I've got it all tape recorded now. I tape recorded it many years ago. But right now, I don't even look at the tape recorded. I just sit down and type it. I think she's on with the computer. Writing a book with the computer makes it very easy for me.
Uh-huh.
Because... I tried it on a typewriter, on a word processor and all, but I made too many mistakes. Right now with a computer, I make a mistake, I can correct it, wipe it out, and don't have to worry, you know, lose very little bit of time or misspell a word. Go back and correct it. The word, a lot of time, you know, you can't go on these word checks on these computers. I have a dictionary around to make sure.
Well, I've got a bunch of questions about the labor ad, but
yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Any question? Yeah, but any question you might have, feel free to ask.
Because part of what I'm doing is I'm turning over interviews that I've done over the years. It started with doing the Working Detroit book and some other projects that made the, like the Calumet to Kalamazoo video that you helped out on years ago.
Yep.
And all those interviews, and I'm turning them over to the university archives. They digitize them. So that's why I have a form, and I'll ask you to let me put that in that collection. But I plan to write a couple things up. And some of it's about the history of the Union University kind of labor education programs. And so that's why I had some questions about some of that. But I was curious, sort of, and you told me about the corn booth stories, which was pretty good in terms of that. So you got involved with all three of the universities?
Oh, yeah. Gene Brooks, Gene and I were great friends.
Uh-huh.
High and I were, too. And, mm-hmm. and then we had Russ Allen and Fred Heller.
Oh, you would have
I didn't know them as well as I knew Jackie Brophy.
Bob Repas.
Bob Repas, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bob. And had Chuck Grapel there at one time, if you remember.
Yep, he was there just before I came. He left just before.
A guy by the name of Peterson was there. I used to see him pretty often.
Okay.
Big, tall guy, Peterson.
Oh, Ron Peters.
Ron Peters, yeah.
He left just when I arrived in 77. Ron had been there, and he went to run the Illinois program.
Right. As I knew, he's still there.
Mm-hmm.
You had, let me see, Dale Brickner. Dale had, I'm trying to think of Scott Tobey.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to Scott?
Scott's still at Michigan State. He's still doing health and safety training, actually.
Oh, good.
One of the only people that I know is still kind of doing the same things. But we had, and so for a few years, you may or may not recall, we had under the end of Reagan and the beginning of, the end of Carter and the Reagan years, MSU, we had this health and safety OSHA grant,
one of those
new direction grants like the steel workers had.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And so during those years, Scott and I used to come down and do quite a few programs at the McClough Local Hall.
Oh, yeah.
But then we also did them for you outstate, too. So it was kind of fun.
Chuck and I, we were a big fighter in OSHA. We had to buy OSHA pass for OSHA pass.
Now there was a big split in the labor movement on whether or not to have state plans or not.
But I know there was a big split. We were for national ourselves. We felt you had to have a national plan. I'm a firm stickler on national plans and everything.
But that's you guys lived with the MyOSHA plan.
We pretty well wrote the MyOSHA plan. Some of the language that they enter into MyOSHA is the language that we negotiated at McLeod. You know?
Right. I was thinking
that. Safety and health program. We were leaders in that safety and health. I was a leader. My dad was killed in a coal mine, you know, and so that made me aware of safety. Like I would tell our guys when we taught a safety class someplace, we can negotiate you a contract that pays you $20 an hour, even not $100 an hour. You come in and get hurt and get killed, it's not going to do you any good. So that's why safety and health is a priority.
Uh-huh.
Why safety and health is number one.
Now, you had the kinds of issues that we've talked about at this local, but then some of the other programs that we did for Michigan State were the outstate ones, so we did stuff for
we did a lot of programs all over the state.
We did a lot of stuff in Midland and Alpena and places
Alpena,
like that.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, we used to do a lot of them.
The Midland local was always a fun local. I don't know if you remember 12075.
Well, I was part of it, yeah. A big part of 12075, John Pryor. John and I are very good friends. You know, we worked together, and he was with the local and I was with the international. We worked together.
But you did a lot of programs yourself, but you also used the universities a lot.
Yeah, I did.
You found that a useful relationship?
I always got along very good. You know, with Gene Brooke and with whoever was the director at Michigan State, whether it's Dale Bricker. Jackie was there for quite a while before they finally brought Dale in.
Mm-hmm. With Fred Haler.
Yeah.
And Russ Allen was there for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, and, I think we developed a main program, and I was chairman there for quite a while.
Of the Labor Advisory Committee.
Yeah, right.
MSU.
Labor Advisory Committee, right. And while I was the chairman, I don't know if you remember Eula Tate.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that program.
Yeah, Eula Tate, we negotiated the women labor leadership, women labor leadership.
Mm-hmm. The women minority leadership program.
We got it. Yeah, right.
Right.
We had Eula Tate and Bob Cunningham.
Right, at Wayne State.
Yeah, right. Was in charge of that. Now we negotiated that with Governor Blanchard, and we got a $200,000 grant for the program. And when Engler come in, that was one of his first red lines to get rid of that one. And I thought that was a big mistake on his part because that was a good program.
Well, it was an interesting one because you had a consortium of six big unions and six universities.
That's right.
At that point, a couple of the smaller universities got involved too.
Yeah.
In Oakland and Eastern.
I was very disappointed with Engler in that one, but I figured, well, that's typical Republican. What can you expect, you know? They're not for social programs.
But those were the years that you were on that advisory board and used to...
Oh, yeah. You know, we met with the governor. I forget who was with me.
I would assume Carol Hutton would have been another union person that was involved.
Oh, yeah, Carol and I were very great friends. Yeah, Carol and I both were involved in that very heavily. We met with the governor. Carol and I met with the governor.
But I think for the union university side, I think Brickner was one of the key, and then other names that you've mentioned. But High and Joyce were, too, the Corn Blues.
Well, Brickner was... He was one of a kind, man. I like that Dale Brickner. Yeah, I like Dale. Dale, you know, we sung out of the same hymn books. Well, you know, most of the labor study guys, you, John, most of you guys, we all sung out of the same hymn books. The secretary, I forget her name. What's her name? I like her.
Well, the one who was Dale's secretary for many years was Lillian Sains,
Lillian,
the short gal.
Yeah, right. But you got another one up there that is involved now. She's still involved.
Oh, Deborah.
Debbie. I like Debbie.
Yeah, she was, she's now the union president. Deb Bittner, talking about.
Yeah, right, that's it.
She's now the clerical technical union president. So it's kind of fun. So you
what's John Beck doing? Is he doing anything?
Well, I was going to tell you at some point that the program has really declined at Michigan State. They all have. But the Michigan State one is basically gone. And John does a little bit of labor ed, and newer person Michelle Kaminsky does a little labor ed, but they both mostly teach regular university classes now. And everybody else is retired,
John?
Or gone elsewhere.
But what happened?
Well,
did John drop the ball when Dale left, or what?
Well, that's a bit of it. Some of it's just, quite frankly, the decline in the labor movement. Dale always said that this really exists because unions want it and push for it. And if they ever, and quite frankly, I think some of it was sort of the decline in the UAW and the AFL State Fed pushing the universities to keep these programs.
You know what it is, John? Really, a decline in the leadership. It all starts with the leadership. Walter Reuther wanted it. He believed in it. Walter believed in it. Doug Frazier, these guys believed in it. I even think Bob King believes in it, but, you know, the years between Dale or Frazier and King, you know, just a big gap between it was.
Well, it's years of decline.
Yeah, sure. You don't see that.
Significant decline.
Steel workers, you see anything in steel workers? You don't see nothing. They're not interested. You know, I had different.
So the steel workers are not continuing to do much programming either?
I had Ron Houghton, one of my staff guys, he wanted to be the education guy. He just wanted the name. He didn't want to work. He didn't do nothing.
That's too bad.
And the same thing with each one of them. You know, they wanted the name, but didn't want to work. The thing is, like I've said in so many times, to so many different people, all organized labor is looking for is a leader, someone to lead them. It's not that the labor's declined, that people don't believe in union. People believe in the union.
No,
they love their union, but... What's happening? You know, where's the excitement at? My theory was this. If there's no excitement, create some. Create some, because you've got to keep your people excited. That's what we did marches everywhere. They need to march it. We let them pay up, man. We loaded up one. They need one in Pittsburgh.
You were always there. All of those state safety and health, the April programs, the worker memorial days.
Oh, yeah.
You would always show up in a contingent of steel workers. But not everybody did that.
I'm not. Yeah, that's right. I'm very, very disappointed. Well, they don't like to have me around, you know, because I say, look, I'm going to tell you one thing. If we don't fight to keep what we got, we're going to lose it. Labor is a fight every day. It's not just when you feel like it. It's every day. You've got to fight every day. You've got to fight like a tiger to actually win the stuff, and then you've got to fight like even harder to keep it once you get it, because you've got so many people trying to pull it away from you in so many different directions. Well, you got to be out there every day fighting. And it seems like our leaders are comfortable in their environment right now. And that environment isn't very good.
Yeah. In shock, I sometimes think from how things are so different. But your point could be well taken. I was going to ask you about something that goes back a little ways, because I know you were a big role in it. One of the things you had to deal with in the late 70s and early 80s was the decline in the prominence of steel in America, and including with McClouth. And there was a lot of attempts to do labor management cooperation and concession contracts, and you guys sort of saved McClouth Steel through that.
And saved Great Lakes or National for quite a while.
Is that going to be in your new book, or is that coming after?
No, it comes in later book. That's going to be another book. I got about four books, I'll be right.
Okay.
And that'll come in. It'll tell about the McClouth story, about the ESOPs, about the cooperative partnership, how we work with the cooperative partnership, and how we set the cooperative partnerships up with the company. With cooperative partnership, we make sure the company, and not all the company, and all the union understood that a cooperative partnership is this, that the company don't just do what they want to do and the union cooperates with them. Vice versa, the union don't do what they want to do and the company cooperates with them. And both of them work together in a cooperative manner to make things happen and to make the company better, to make the company more profitable, make the company more efficient and make it more profitable. And the whole thing, that's what it's all about. And like I told, kept telling all of our guys and complained, a lot of complainers. They didn't want that.
Well, people just used.
And I said, look, I have a local, I have a union leader. My responsibility is to take care of you. And number one is to keep you working. If I go out here and negotiate something the company can't afford and shut the job down, that's not helping you. I said, when I'm helping you, it's when I'm negotiating with the company and the company's making a profit and they can pay you, they can pay your benefits, and they can pay all this stuff. That's my job, to see that happens, not to be in the business of closing companies down, but to make companies profitable.
But there were a lot of, there must have been tough internal politics.
Oh, my God.
There were a lot of people who didn't believe in.
Well, I tell you, John, it got to the point where it's so bad, I was catching all the flack, and I tell the guys, don't worry about the politics of me getting reelected. I'll get reelected because I'm a good politician. I know how to get reelected. I said, you know how I'm a good politician? You do the things that people want, they're going to reelect you. There's a certain few that want to be destructive. Now, what we have to do is work together and make sure that people keep working. If we can make sure people keep working, people keep on voting for me. Mm-hmm. It's when I put them out of business when they don't vote for me.
So you stayed as district director till when?
I was 2006.
Okay.
I retired 2006.
Were those concessions for McClouth and that some of the toughest of all the work you ever had to do during that?
Well, the toughest thing, you know, I was a gladiator in the labor movement, and I was a fighter. And like I said, I educated myself to the point of where I knew that if I'm not going to be a mediocre staff guy, I want to be the best. I don't want to be just a staff guy. Mm-hmm. I want to be the best. I want to be able to, when I speak, that the company listens to me, or when I speak, the membership listens to me, because I know what I'm talking about. And I think the toughest thing for me to do was going from the gladiator type to the guy that was a cooperative and got along with the company and built relationships with the company. Because the way my theory was in collective bargaining for a long time, up until we hit some hard times, was the company bargains and we collect.
Uh-huh.
That was my theory of collective bargaining. And to change from being a gladiator over to being a looker. And like I said, only a fool will change your mind, you know. But you got to make these. I knew right away, if we're going to survive, we have to make these changes. And like when people said, hurry, you said you wouldn't tell. I said, you're only a fool won't change your mind, brother. And I'm not a fool.
Uh-huh.
That we have to change our mind. If we don't, we're not going to be in existence. We're going to go out of existence.
Now, was the International helpful in those kind of discussions?
Or
were you really on your own in the district office?
Well, in the ESOP, President McBride told me I was on my own. On the ESOP at McLeod, he said, I don't believe in the ESOPs.
They didn't support it then?
We won't put one penny into it. We'll stop you. We'll try to stop you. But we won't put no penny into getting the feasibility study. So we raised the money ourselves, the members. We raised the organizing committee and raised enough money to get the feasibility study. And then after Len Williams come in, Len Williams started paying for feasibility studies because he could see the wisdom and, you know, keep mm-hmm. people working. But Lloyd, he figured that, well, if the company can't run it, you can't either. I said, Lloyd, I'm not trying to run the company. I said, all we're trying to do is just save the jobs. We'll hire a management to run the company.
Well, you kept that going 30 extra years.
Well, a long time. Over 2,400 members qualified for retirement in that time we kept it open. And hard thing to do, a real hard thing to do, John, was to come back to the membership and say, look, this is the course we got to take. When I was running for director, you know, my theory was this, we don't take no backward steps. We go forward. We don't have no reverse.
Who are you running against?
Running against John Sadbury.
Okay.
Yeah, old established guy from Great Lakes. And naturally, he wasn't no cooperative partnership kind of guy either. So I had to negotiate those concessions. McLeod had a choice to make. Either you negotiate concessions or the secured creditors will call the note and shut the doors.
Mm-hmm.
And the Judge Woods had already given him the go-ahead sign if we can't get the union and the company to cooperate. So I get together. I called a meeting, I think at least 3,000 people showed up. And I knew.
Where'd you do that kind of a meeting?
It was in the high school gym.
Okay.
All of them didn't get inside. A lot of people on the outside, we had speakers and all that. So, they said, the hands went up. I knew exactly what the hands were going to say. So, they got up. Harry, you said you were going to never negotiate concessions. And you're coming back to us wanting us to take a cut. And I said, brothers, you're absolutely right. I did. I told you that. I said, I did. I told you that. Concessions wasn't even in my vocabulary.
Uh-huh.
That I would never negotiate concessions. I said that. I said, really? And really, when I told you, I meant it. But I'm going to tell you one thing. Only a fool won't change their mind. And I'm certainly not a fool. But the only choice you have is take concessions or look for a job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, which would you rather do? Well, it passed. You didn't have all unanimous. It passed. Not a good majority. But you don't ever get a unanimous vote on the concession.
No. I forget at that time, was district director elected by members or was it?
Always been elected by members.
Okay.
Ring them out.
So there was a vote of all members at each of the local halls or something? And
yeah, well, that's the way they do it. Every local votes.
And how often?
Every 4 years.
Was 4 year position. Okay.
And I was elected 6 different times.
The assistant is an appointee of the director.
Oh, yeah. Everybody else. It's the director. The president, the vice president, secretary, treasurer, and directors are the elected people.
Okay. And so who were your different assistants?
Well, I had Walter Sludge to start with. Walter was District 50. Well, good man.
I interviewed Walter 20 years ago something, mostly about District 50 and how it became part of the steelworkers, which was a lot of fun.
Walter was very capable and very, very capable.
I'd forgotten that I interviewed him so long ago, I forgot that he was your assistant.
He was very capable and And very complimentary, he and I complimented each other. He was from the District 50, and I'm from the steelworkers. I felt the only. The right thing to do was to, as assistant, have a District 50 guy.
Now, he wasn't a Midland guy, though.
No, he wasn't.
He was District 50, but from somewhere
else.
Well,
he was here in the Wyandotte area.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Joe Walter had been all over. He'd been all over the country with District 50. He was a director at one time, so.
Working for Lewis as.
Yeah, General Lewis, yeah.
Well, as a kid.
Yep. And then George Watts, that's the other two assistants.
Oh, okay.
But George retired. I didn't replace it. I didn't replace the assistant. Left to fake it because should have didn't have one that I felt would could compliment George or Walter.
Uh-huh. Now, you never had the UP. That always went with Minnesota?
No, I had UP. I was the chief negotiator of those mines up there, yeah.
Okay.
I had them, when they put them together, I had them for about 10, 12 years.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I had the UP. Finally, I got all of Michigan and all of Wisconsin.
Okay.
I retired. I had that for about 12 years.
I can turn off the tape recorder if anything you don't want to say, but how do you feel that the mergers have gone for the steel workers, picking up the allied industrial workers or the paper workers?
You know, the thing is, we've had some good mergers. We've had the two best mergers we had was District 50 and the rubber workers.
Uh-huh.
The other mergers, we more or less...
Not as good.
Tuck in some broke operations like the paper workers. I think we took a shellacking with the paper workers.
In terms of finances?
Well, and otherwise, too.
Oh.
They didn't want to come up to the dues level and all this.
So
you had an imbecile negotiating for the union. That's Kim Siegfried, you know, he used to work for me. And Leo thinks he's the greatest. I think he's about the worst negotiator. What they should have had is someone knew how to negotiate. That's somebody like me. I negotiate with them. They give a store away, John.
The reason I ask is I've interviewed some of the AIW people. You remember who?
Oh, yeah. I liked them. They were good people.
Well, it goes way back to, like, Walter Campbell was one of those AIW guys. And
they were good guys.
They were quite something, the UAW-AFL. But now they're part of the steel workers, and I think that sort of worked for them.
It worked for them good.
But...
Because they were the paper workers.
That's why they ended up.
They didn't have much with a paper worker.
But do you remember the merger that didn't happen where the UAW steel workers and machinists talked? Was that during your time?
I was a big part of that.
I was going to say.
Yeah, I was a big part of that, the three mergers, yeah. I thought it was the worst thing in the world that we didn't do it.
Uh-huh.
That would have been what you'd call a super merger.
Mm-hmm.
That'd been a great merger. I was part of it. I supported it. I still support it. I still think it should go through because all three of them are complementary to each other. They're in good, solid industrial unions. But to what I get with with this paper workers, I don't believe that they're up to par with the steel worker union. The way I look at it,
they're just a little part now of you guys.
Uh-huh.
They're really just a small division of you, aren't they?
Well, the paper workers are, yeah.
Yeah. Merging with the UAW would have been of equals.
Well, now, UAW and machinists, you had a union.
Uh-huh.
Well, you didn't have much. You had a conglomeration of a bunch of failures.
So you were part of those discussions?
With the UAW?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The steelworkers were very much in favor of it.
Oh, yeah, we were very in favor of it. I still have the Unity shirts. Unity 2000. And George Becker and I were very good friends, too. And George, he thought it was a great deal, and I did too. I've always thought it was a great deal. I always thought that the UAW and steelworkers should be together. Machinist is more or less a craft union.
It had been an old AFL, yeah.
Right. So the thing is, that would be a little bit tougher. But the UAW and the steelworkers would be a good merger. I think it should do it.
So why do you think it didn't happen back then? Mostly was UAW politics?
I think it's just way too much politics on both sides, steelworkers and UAW, because everyone, the steelworkers, didn't feel the same as I did. I felt we should do it. And the reason I thought we should do it, it would have been complimentary for both the steelworkers and the UAW. They could both, it was a lot of game. They both would bring a lot to the table, John.
Mm-hmm.
Machinists would too, but I think we'd have been a lot better, you know, with just the two. But mm-hmm. I was all in favor of the three, though.
So I donate these interviews, and they digitize them?
Hmm?
They digitize these interviews. Well, this is a digital recorder. But they have a big collection of different interviews, not just mine, but different kinds of ones in the state of Michigan through the MSU archives. I also give them to Wayne State. So this is an agreement that you let me give them to them. It has nothing to do with taking away any ownership or anything.
Oh, just, no, no. I'm sorry. I'm sure I don't mind. Only print my name, huh?
That's the most, it's the signing underneath. I just hadn't done it yet.
I don't know what all we got on there.
But the signing there is the most important.
Right. I don't know what all we got on there, John, but anything I said, I'm not backing it up.